This is not just any podcast. This is Historical Inaccuracies, a history podcast. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of Historical Inaccuracies, a history podcast, and thank you very much for joining us today. We are four friends, two Scots, Kel.
Hello.
And Kelly.
Hello.
A Greek, Maria.
Hello.
And me, an English woman, Becky, who love to chat shit and talk about history. So our subject this week is a sensitive one, and one that we hope will raise awareness of the importance of the long history of the LGBTQ plus community. Given the incredible breadth and depth of the umbrella, it would be impossible for us to do it justice in the time that we have, but Maria, Kelly and I have each chosen a part of the umbrella to discuss as allies, and we hope that we can and will do it some small justice. So, on to business. Cam.
Yes.
I'm sure that you know what LGBTQ plus stands for, but can you tell us, please, what LGBTQQIAA stands for?
Right. Can we just kind of like slow that down? So, lesbians, bisexuals, transgenders, and then what was it after that? LGBT?
Okay, so,
right.
So, L, lesbian, G, gay, B,
bisexual,
T, transgender.
Transgender.
So, Q, you got right, was queer, but there's another queer. Q as well.
Questionable?
Questioning,
is that
yes.
Right? Okay,
yeah.
Is that kind of like you're not entirely sure?
Yeah.
Okay, right. Okay, I get that. Okay.
Okay,
I. Independent?
Intersex,
okay.
Yeah. A?
Asexual.
Yes, and there's another A as well.
Oh, God.
Is what we would be considered in this show, I hope.
What we would be considered?
Yeah.
A-hetero?
I don't know what that is. Allies.
Allies. Allies. Ah, allies. Right, okay. So friends of the LGBTQ plus community.
Yes.
So we would also be included in it?
That's
great, exactly.
The general phrase when I was looking it up, and I looked on quite a few websites because I was terrified of getting it wrong. So I do apologise to our listeners if I have got it wrong. But generally speaking, they use the LGBTQ plus acronym. That's the one that they prefer to use. But there have been other ones, including the LGBTTQQIAA one, which is just unbelievably long.
Can I just interject here for a little second?
Yeah.
America has just elected its first high-ranking openly transgender elected official by the name of Sarah McBride, who was elected to a seat in Delaware's state legislature. Congratulations, Miss McBride.
Thanks.
I just want to put that in there.
That's very exciting.
So, let's get started.
So, in terms of lesbian history, do you know anything at all about lesbian history? Do you know any famous historical lesbians?
No. But I'm happy to learn. I'm willing to learn. Please educate me.
Maria, would you like to take us away?
I thought you're asking the wrong person because I mainly focused on one figure plus another one, but mostly on one figure that whose sexuality is like even today debated, but it's notorious in the history of lesbians, let's say, and that's the Greek poet Sappho. So Sappho was an archaic Greek poet from the island of Lesbos, or Lesbos, the island of overmastering passions, as is used to be in antiquity. And Sappho's sexuality has long been the subject of debate. The Greeks seem to have thought of Sappho as the female counterpart of Homer. He was known as the poet. She was known as the poetess. And many, many scholars now see her poetry as an attempt to appropriate and feminize the diction and subject matter of heroic epic, which is a bit of a side note. Today, for most, Sappho is a symbol of women loving women, the common term lesbian is an allusion to Sappho originating from the name of the island of Lesbos or Lesbos, where she was born. However, she's not always been considered that. In classical Athenian comedy, Sappho was caricatured as a promiscuous heterosexual woman. And it's not until the Hellenistic period that the first testimonia, which explicitly discuss Sappho's homoeroticism, are preserved. And some ancient authors do not appear to have believed that Sappho did in fact have sexual relationships with other women. And as late as the 10th century, the Suda records that Sappho was slanderously accused of having sexual relationships with her female pupils. Now, I think the most common, the most like famous thing about Sappho was in fact the ambiguity regarding her sexuality. And it has been a controversial topic from the start. But indeed, it's crazy that in Greek popular culture of the time, of the classical period and afterwards, Sappho was known primarily as an oversexed, my God, predator of men. And it was, in fact, this is a random bit of history, this was the ancient cliche for lesbians. When we hear the word today, we do think of love between women, but when the ancient Greeks heard the word, they thought of, it's very explicit, but of fellatio? Any comments?
Do you mean fellatio?
Oh, fellatio.
Fellatio, yes, I know this word.
Okay, because the Greek...
they could not have said that any more creepy. Yes,
fellatio, yes.
Because, like, apparently, I don't know if my sources are correct, but the Greek verb lesbiazin, means to act like someone from Lesbos, meaning performing fellatio, an activity for which inhabitants of the island were thought to have a particular talent in. And I have to quote my source. I think this is something I picked up from an article in of 2015 in the New Yorker, so blame them, not me. So among, again, as I said, I'm going to repeat basically a bit more of what I said with a bit more information. Her sexuality is still very much debated, but she is known as to be like the first lesbian, let's say. Early translators of Sappho sometimes heterosexualize her poetry. A translation of her ode to Aphrodite portrayed the object of Sappho's desire as male. A reading that was followed by virtually every other translator of the poem until the 12th century, while in 1781, someone else said that one of her poems was written about Sappho's love of a guy called Phaon. Another scholar argued that Sappho's feelings for other women were entirely idealistic and non-sensual. And it's nothing but like a friendly affection towards women. And these were comments that, you know, make one wonder what language would Sappho use to describe her feelings if they had been ones of sexual excitement. Because if you do read her works, I think it's for me, it's very clearly there. It was, I think, near the 1970s, it was argued that the same poem that we just explained contained proof positive of her lesbianism. And of course, that's because of any critique at the time was embedded in the values of the era that they were examined at and the views of the person writing them. Today, it's generally accepted that Sappho's poetry portrays homoerotic feelings, and it's clearly a celebration of eros, the Greek word for love, between women. And basically, again, in the end of the 20th century, some scholars did debate again, question whether Sappho was a lesbian. And they were quoted as saying that Sappho herself would have no idea what people mean when they call her nowadays a homosexual. However, I think her work is not examined without her sexuality being taken into account. I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but it's never been far from the center of scholarship about her. So the eagerness to come up with innocent explanations for the poet's attachment to young women persisted, and there were many that sort of like tried to create the idea that Sappho was the head of a girls' boarding school, a matron whose interest in her pupils were purely academical. And another theory made her like into this priestess that was like leading an association of young women who devoted themselves to the cult of the goddess Aphrodite. Some of the people said that these cultivian women were companions or students, and it was this like female collective where she was instructing people on how like to lead themselves to marriage, and you know, it was like not like homoeroticism, but just praise of the general attractiveness of the girl, celebrating her readiness for wedlock and integration into society later. And today, thank God, classicists have no problem with the idea of Sappho just being gay. Do you know what I mean? And it's just like, maybe at the end of the day, the poems are deeply personal expressions of her private homoerotic passion. And you know, it's still left to the debate of, and in people's minds, was she or was she not? But if you just take, you know, take from it that her, if you read her poems, I think, and if you just, you know, poems are meant to be read and left to the interpretation of the reader, of the audience. So it's really up to you to decide. But if you like, also think that lesbian comes from the name Lesbos, and I think I visited Mytilene, which is part of Lesbos once. And there's this famous village called Eresos, which is, I think, a go-to destination for lesbian couples around the world. And even if it's just like, you know, for like, you know, just urban legend that she was the protector or the first lesbian, I would like to choose that side of the story, again, with the way I interpret her, like her work. And I think it's just like a beautiful, beautiful notion of where this, the you know, the etymology of the word originated. Quoting Sappho, I don't know if this stands, you know, stands as proof. For, as I said, for many readers, she was the feminist heroine or a gay role model or both. And what another like icon of our theme today, Judith Butler, once said, as far as I know, there was only me and a woman called Sappho. So on that note, I'll take you to Judith Butler for a wee bit, an American philosopher and gender theorist whose work has influenced political philosophy, ethics, and the fields of third wave feminist, queer, and literary theory. Butler is best known for their books, Gender Trouble, Feminism, and the Subversion of Identity. It's amazing. Read it if you can. And Bodies That Matter, on the Discursive Limits of Sex, in which they challenge conventional notions of gender and develop their theory of gender performativity. This theory had a major influence on feminist and queer scholarship, and their works are often studied in film studies courses emphasizing gender studies and performativity in discourse. Butler has supported lesbian and gay rights movements and has spoken out on many contemporary political issues. And just some sort of like critique on Butler's work. McGill University professor Danny Barney said that Butler's work on gender, sex, sexuality, queerness, feminism, Buddhist political speech and ethics has changed the way scholars all over the world think, talk and write about identity, subjectivity, power and politics. And of course, it also changed the lives of countless people whose bodies, whose genders, whose sexualities and desires have made them subject to violence, exclusion and oppression. So woohoo, Judith. And that sort of like concludes my segment.
I got a bit triggered by your segment on Judith Butler just because I'd done her at uni. Like, I used one of her CDs for my dissertation, which was, oh my God, what was it? Depictions of Christianity in American Horror Cinema of the early 2000s. So there was a lot of gender performativity to be discussed in that. But it's just that way where that's the only, I just associate her with all of those, like, those dark days of trying to draft my dissertation. And just trying to get my head around our theory, but.
So, I have a wee question for Maria. Jokes. What were lesbian relationships in ancient Greece frowned upon? Because I know there's been a bit of discussion about kind of like Aristotle, and I believe, from what I kind of like, if I can remember it, he was a bit of a woman hater. Like, he genuinely had, like, this adverse feelings to women. It was all about kind of, like, men and, you know, like,
you're very spot on, actually.
Is that right?
Yeah, but you're very spot on, because I read for Sappho at some point, I read somewhere that it said that Aristotle had was quoted saying she was great, although she was a woman. So that is very true. And I think I might be wrong there. I think in parts of Greece, except for Sparta, where women were held to very high esteem, they were like a rex, Latin version for a thing or an object. That was the you know, kind of like on the class or the structure, they were like the bottom, along with children, I think, and slaves, rex, like a thing. Might be wrong, but yeah, that's a Latin version of the word thing, an object. But that's kind of like, but I think that's the most, to be fair, I think mostly that's women everywhere until like quite recently, so.
Did they not try and this totally comes from having played Assassin's Creed Odyssey, where you had to basically save this woman, but did they not I remember seeing that, and one of the things in that game is that women weren't allowed to attend the Olympic Games, and yes. If they did try, they would get thrown off a cliff.
Yes, and there's been recorded one supposedly woman in history that dressed up like a man and entered the Olympics, and then I think to be eligible to vote, of course, you had to be like 21 and a citizen of being male, etc., etc. So women were not like one of the least of the priorities of the state at the time. Not a very progressive country, if you think that we gave birth to democracy.
If you had a penis.
Exactly. As per usual.
Screw you, Cam.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
No, I'm good. Thank you very much, Maria. That was really interesting. Thank you very much.
Great. Well, if you have no further questions, then thank you very much, Maria. That was really interesting.
Very welcome.
So moving on to the G aspect of it, so gay history. So do you know when homosexuality stopped being a capital crime?
1964?
No. So homosexuality stopped being a capital crime in 1861.
Ah,
but okay. It was still a crime.
Right. Okay.
So you stopped being hung for it in 1861, which I'm sure was of much comfort to the people that were hung before that. But even though it wasn't, in 1861, it was no longer a capital crime. It didn't mean that there wasn't already a thriving gay community in London. And I want to very, very briefly talk about Molly houses. So Molly houses in particular became safe places for people to go to. They could go. They were queer spaces, is the term that I saw when I was looking this up, where men could come together to socialise or have sex in secret and hopefully safely, or in safety, should I say. Although the authorities were still looking for these places, so they still had to be careful. But these dens of, in sometimes negotiable affection, would be very well frequented and were a kind of safe place for the people in them to express and really be themselves. I would love to go further into that if we had time, but we don't really, considering how much we still have to get through. So I would like to give a specific example of one individual, Alan Turing, as an example of the importance of gay individuals to our history. Know anything about Alan Turing?
The Enigma Code.
Yeah.
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 Yes.
He's also going to be on the £50 note as well.
Fantastic. About fucking time.
I know.
Yeah.
So, Alan Turing, born on the 23rd of June 1912. His intelligence shined early, and despite the frustrations of his tutors at his less than enthusiastic learning of classical languages, he ended up studying as an undergraduate at King's College, Cambridge, and received a first in mathematics. Apropos of nothing, to me, that is incredibly amazing, because I sucked at maths. Really did not do well at all. In 1935, at the age of just 22, by the way, which is younger than all of us, he became a fellow of the college on the strength of a dissertation proving the central limit theorem. Now, I'm not going to lie to you, I am nowhere near intelligent enough to be able to explain that, but if people want to, they can look it up. The central limit theorem. In 1936, he published a paper on computable numbers with an application to the Einsteinstung problem, which I think that's how you say it, which is far too intelligent, again, for me to understand, but has been called easily the most influential maths paper in history. The idea that there are influential maths papers is very troubling to me. Turing later obtained his PhD from Princeton in 1938 on his dissertation on systems of logic based on ordinals, and then returned to the UK just before the outbreak of the Second World War. And this is where his story becomes relevant to us. So, during the Second World War, Turing worked for the Government Code and Cipher School, or GCNCS, at Bletchley Park, which I think we've all heard of, which was Britain's code-breaking centre and focused on cryptanalysis, which, for those of you who have no idea what it is deciphering codes used by Nazi Germany to hide communications from prying eyes. He devised a number of techniques for speeding the breaking of German ciphers, but is probably most famous for his work on the bomb machine, which took the deciphering work that had already been done by Polish analysts and improved on it and created a machine which could effectively break the Enigma codes. The bomb, as they called it, became one of the primary tools used to attack Enigma in ciphered messages, and by the end of the war, over 200 bombs were in use. So this really did have massive world implications. The work of Turing and his team was crucial in cracking intercepted coded messages and enabled the Allies to defeat the Nazis in many crucial engagements, including the Battle of the Atlantic. So it's very hard to estimate the precise effect that his work had on the war. But at the upper end, it has been estimated that his work shortened the Second World War by 2 years and saved over 14 million lives.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, that's how many of us can say that we've saved 14 million lives?
It's incredible.
It is. Nice. Mm-hmm. So after the war, in 1948, he joined the Victoria University of Manchester, and in 1950 released or published the Computing Machinery and Intelligence paper. And the paper addressed the problem of artificial intelligence and proposed an experiment that became known as the Turing test, which was an attempt to define a standard for a machine to be called intelligent. In the paper, Turing suggested that rather than building a program to stimulate the adult mind, it would be better to produce a simpler one to simulate a child's mind and then subject it to a course of education. And here's the fun bit, ladies and gents. A reversed form of the Turing test is still widely used on the internet today.
Oh,
the
wow.
The CAPTCHA test is intended to determine whether the user is a human or a computer. So his work still has totally modern world
annoying thing. Find the pavement.
The one where you have to find the blooming trees and stuff.
Yeah, find the cars, find the fire hydrant. Why is it always American? That's what I want to know. Well, anyway, yeah. So
wow.
Right? That blew my mind. I was sat there for a good 5 minutes going, you know. So now I'd like to move on to the unpleasant part of Turing's story. In 1952, Turing's house was burgled by an acquaintance of his then partner, 19-year-old Arnold Murray. And during the police investigation into the crime, Turing acknowledged a sexual relationship with Murray. The two were very quickly charged with gross indecency, and after being convicted, Turing was given a choice of either prison or probation with chemical castration.
I've heard this.
Yeah. He chose probation and underwent a year-long course of unnecessary chemical punishment. This conviction led to the removal of his security clearance, and he was no longer employed by the UK government, although he did keep his academic roles. Not that that's of any consolation.
Mm-hmm.
On the 8th of June 1954... Turing's housekeeper found him dead at the age of 41 of what was later found to be cyanide poisoning. It has been ruled as a suicide, but there are a lot of conspiracy theories around it, but we'll not go into that just now. The same year, so 1954, the Wolfenden Committee recommended that gay sex should no longer be illegal. Now, it wasn't until 1967 that some gay acts were decriminalised, so the majority were, but there's still some really obscure ones like having sex in a toilet and stuff like that, the public toilet, that kind of thing, which is ridiculous. But anyway, so yeah, he still wouldn't have, you know, it still would have affected him. In 2009, following an internet campaign, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown made an official public apology to Alan Turing on behalf of the British government. And what he said, I think, really kind of struck a chord. So what he said was,
While Turing was dealt with under the law of the time and we can't put the clock back, his treatment was, of course, utterly unfair, and I am pleased to have the chance to say how deeply sorry I and we all are for what happened to him. So on behalf of the British government and all those who live freely thanks to Alan's work, I am very proud to say we're sorry. You deserved so much better.
You're here.
Very true. Very true.
Absolutely. A further campaign requesting that the British government pardon Turing for his conviction of gross indecency followed. And eventually, the Policing and Crime Act 2017, which is informally known as the Alan Turing Law, came into force. And it serves as an amnesty law to retroactively pardon men who were cautioned or convicted under historical legislation that outlawed homosexual acts. The law applies in England and Wales, and it's thought that this affects around just over 50,000 men. That's a lot of people. So Turing's legacy is one of immense importance, both militarily and legally, as well as being one which ends in an incredibly unhappy manner, as it did with tens of thousands of other men. Mm. It's impossible to do him justice in one 10-minute segment, but I've given it to a go. Thoughts?
Wow. Yeah. Well done, Becky.
That, I assume, was to Turing and not me, because I did fuck all.
No.
I get very confused by what I tried to read into some of the papers, and yeah. I got very discouraged very quickly because I am nowhere near intelligent enough.
Yeah. I just think it's an absolute disgrace, you know, the amount of work that this man contributed towards the war effort. You know what I mean? As you just kind of highlighted there, it's believed that he reduced the war by 2 years. And, you know, potentially saved lives of 14 million people. And he was treated in such a despicable manner. Mm. I mean, it's a fucking joke. Sorry, pardon my language, but it is.
Yeah.
It's just, it's fucking criminal. And the fact that it took until 2009, the record, you know, what he'd done, not just for kind of like Britain, but for like the whole world. I mean, if it hadn't been for that, and potentially, I mean, people say, oh, we could be speaking German now. You know what I mean? But it's a very real. So exactly, it's a very real fact. You know what I mean? And I thought it was really interesting what you said about the Turing test.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of reverse Turing test with the capture. I think we've all kind of been like, oh, those fucking pavements. But yeah, you know, I thought, no, we're sure though, yeah. I mean, I thought that was actually quite interesting. But no, Becky, thank you very much. That was really interesting.
Thank you. Moving on, Cam. Do you know anything at all about trans history? Do you know any examples of trans individuals?
I'll be honest, in terms of trans history, I'm not that clued up.
Fair enough. I don't know anything either. Would you mind?
Yes, so apologies in advance as well, because if you hear any banging in the background, it is bonfire night tomorrow and the sun's just went down where I am, and all I can hear every now and then is just fire. People are starting to set off fireworks, so apologies in advance if you hear any banging in the background, that's why. So I've chosen the figure that I've chosen as a representative of the trans community in this podcast is Dr. James Barry. I should sort of come with a little disclaimer before I kind of go into talking about Dr. Barry, because I'm going to use he, him pronouns throughout, but I think there's been a bit of debate as to whether Dr. Barry would be considered as trans in the context that we know trans to be today. There's been sort of debate between historians as to whether he was intersex, whether he was trans, whether he was like a woman who had dressed as a man to sort of get ahead in a male-dominated field. There's a lot of kind of conflicting ideas over his actual gender identity. But I think in any case, it's safe to say that he did not conform to the sort of typical gender roles of the time anyway. And the fact as well, when I was reading up about him, that he was known as a man for 50 years of his life and he wanted to be remembered as such, I think it's sort of appropriate just to use he, him pronouns for the purposes of this segment. So with that sort of said, I've sort of done it as sort of like a kind of like small potted history. So I've sort of just went through it kind of like starting from when he was born and then up until his death. So basically, James Barry was born, well, they don't actually know, they don't have an exact birthday. A lot of his early life is a bit of a mystery. But they've sort of worked out from a letter that was sent by Mary Ann Bulkley, who was James Barry's mother. So she had sent a letter making reference to her second child, and they sort of, and saying that her second child was 15, so they sort of, they worked out an estimated age for him that way. But he was born in round about 1789 as Margaret Ann Buckley in Ireland, the second child of Jeremiah and Mary Ann Buckley, who I've just mentioned. So I can't really take you into like a sort of detailed history of his early life because there's not much known. What we do know is that Mary Ann, so Barry's mother, was called James Barry, and that's who Barry would eventually take his name from once he decided to be known as a man. So he was a celebrated Irish artist at London's Royal Academy, and when he died in 1806, it was sort of his identity slash name that Barry assumed. There's also, although there's not much known about his early life, there is a suggestion based on something that will come into a little bit later. There's a suggestion that as a child, Margaret Ann Buckley may have been sexually assaulted, which produced a pregnancy. Now, this is before the age of 20, so I'll come into that a little bit later on. But there's no hard evidence to support this, but they think that it is quite likely. So, like I said, I'll come back to that later on. But yeah, what we do know is that by the age of 20, so in 1809, Margaret Ann Buckley had become James Barry and had sort of assumed his late uncle's identity in order to be a doctor, because he had sort of extreme ambitions to get forward in the medical field. And at that time, as we all know, if you were a woman, there is absolutely no chance in hell you're getting to be a doctor at all in 1809. So that's again where a lot of the discussion comes as to whether some people say, oh, well, it wouldn't be considered trans because, you know, in those days, you could argue that it just became a man in order to get ahead in his medical field. So it's kind of stimulated a lot of discussion. But yeah, so in the early days, it was with the help of Mary Ann, his mum, and her late brother's friends that he was able to take up the identity of his uncle and enrol in the University of Edinburgh Medical School. So initially when he was enrolled, there was comments that were sort of raised as to Barry's sort of height, voice, skin, that led kind of the officiates at the University of Edinburgh to think he was a young boy. So there were sort of questions as to whether he was old enough to enrol and as to be a doctor. They were eventually sort of persuaded otherwise and persuaded that Barry was old enough to attend, and he qualified as a doctor in 1812. So by 1813, after qualifying as a doctor, Barry moves to London and then passes examination of the Royal College of Surgeons. And then that very same year, he was commissioned into the British Army. So we're doing well. I mean, at this point, he is 24, which is more than I've done in my life. So 1816, Barry then gets promoted to assistant surgeon to the forces and gets posted to Cape Town, South Africa. In 1822, after being whilst stationed in Cape Town, he forms a close relationship with South African Governor Lord Charles Somerset. And Somerset appoints Barry as colonial medical inspector in South Africa. I mean, the sort of colonial aspects of parts of Barry's life, we can sort of, I think we would be here all day if we sort of went into the sort of more problematic aspects of what that means. But just in terms of Barry's life, he was appointed to that role. In 1827, Barry was then promoted. So this is 5 years later. He was promoted to Surgeon of the Armed Forces and then was posted to Mauritius in 1828. In 1829, Barry risked reputational trouble by going absent from Mauritius without leave to return to England and treat Charles Somerset, who had fallen seriously ill. And he stayed there until Somerset died in 1831. So I'll come back to Somerset in a bit, because he's an important figure. In 1836, Barry was posted to Jamaica in St. Helena and had a clash with another army surgeon that got him arrested and court-martialed, although he was actually later acquitted for that, because he was sort of known for having quite a fiery temper, and it kind of got him into a few situations over the years, which I'll come into again later on. It's not the end of confrontations for Barry, let's just say. 1840, Barry is posted to the Leeward Islands and the Windward Islands in the West Indies. And while he was stationed there, he focused on improving conditions for the troops and was promoted to principal medical officer. So he's just promotion after promotion as Barry. 1846, Barry is posted to Malta, where he lived through a cholera epidemic in 1850. And 1851, Barry's posted to Corfu, and on Corfu he was promoted again to duty inspector general of hospitals. And from there, he briefly, while he was on leave, visited Crimea and had another famous run-in with a certain Florence Nightingale, which I'll come back to later on. 1857, Barry was posted to Canada and granted local rank of Inspector General of Hospitals, again another promotion. 1859, despite his protests, the army finally retired Barry due to his age and ill health, and he lived in retirement for the next 6 years in London. And in 1865, on the 25th of July, Barry died of dysentery. So this is where it's upon Barry's death that his identity, his sort of birth identity is called into question by the people who examine his body. So after his death, Barry had explicitly requested that he wanted to be buried in the clothes that he died in, and he wanted to be unwashed. He didn't want anyone to look at his body, he just wanted to be buried. But no one, I mean absolutely no one, respected this wish. So after he died, his body was laid out, and the woman who had, the sort of charwoman who was charged with stripping the body and cleaning it, discovered not only female genitalia, but also evidence of pregnancy stretch marks on the body, which is what has led historians to sort of speculate as to the childhood sexual assault that Barry likely encountered having resulted in a pregnancy, because it's likely that according to the woman who laid out his body, he had been pregnant. So and I think one of the sort of theories that they put forward for this is that when Barry was a teenager, he had a sister called Juliana who was born, and they've sort of posited that it's likely that Juliana was passed off as Barry's sister but was actually Barry's child, so Barry's daughter, who was sort of passed off as his sister. Just in terms of dates, that's how they've worked it out. Barry had started being known as a man and was enrolled in medical school in 1820 when he was 20 years old. So that's the sort of window that they see as that having happened then, and it matches up with Juliana's birth date. So that's how they sort of have came to that conclusion. So the woman who discovered Barry's birth sex also then tried to extort payment from Barry's physician. So Barry's physician had issued a male medical death certificate upon his death, a guy called Major D.R. McKinnon, and she demanded payment from Dr. McKinnon for essentially saying, I've discovered that Dr. Barry is biologically female. If you don't pay me, then I'm like, she basically blackmailed him. She said she was going to go and tell everybody that he had falsified, in her eyes, his medical records. But Dr. McKinnon essentially said, fuck off, I'm not, like, you can go and tell whoever you like, I'm not sort of giving any money to you whatsoever. So she took it to the press and she got paid by the press. So essentially Barry's inverted commas secret was out all over the papers, which was the sort of opposite of what he had wanted upon his death. And then in a very, very standard British Army fashion, the British Army then suppressed the truth of the story by sealing all medical records of Barry for the next 100 years. They didn't want anyone to find out about this inverted commas scandal. And it was only in the 1950s that these records were actually accessed and we actually knew anything about Barry's birth gender. They managed to essentially keep it secret for over 100 years. But yeah, so that's the kind of horrible sort of ending of Barry's life. But in terms of his achievements, he achieved a lot in the time that he was working both as a doctor and in the armed forces. So the sort of two main things that he's known for is one, vastly improving the medical conditions in the West Indies, not only for the British Army like officers who were stationed there, but also for the local population. So he would treat, and that includes enslaved people as well. He would treat everyone like soldier, slave, whoever. It doesn't matter what status they had in like early 19th century society. He would treat them. And also, interestingly, he performed the first caesarean in which both the woman and child survived. So that was obviously a really, really good achievement. It had kind of like a few interesting encounters in his life as well. So he was vegetarian and teetotal, which was sort of virtually unheard of in like the early 19th century. He had very sort of strict rules as to what he ate and what he drank. And I think I'd mentioned earlier as well, his relationship with Lord Charles Somerset. So Barry and Somerset had a very, very close relationship. And it led to rumours and an accusation in 1824 of homosexuality between Lord Charles and Barry. Basically, Barry and Somerset were accused publicly of homosexuality. Now, at this stage, not like they were both acquitted. They were neither. Obviously, the army, everyone in public perceived Barry as a man. And so the fact that Lord Charles Somerset never... Essentially, historians agree that if Charles Somerset knew about Barry's gender, or birth gender, he didn't reveal it to kind of try and save himself, if you like, from being convicted. Obviously, they didn't know that they would be acquitted, but at no point did Charles Somerset say, well, actually, like, Barry is technically a woman. He never said any of that. So either there's debate as to whether he knew, and they just genuinely were not in a sexual relationship, or if he did know, he loved Barry that much that he never said anything for that reason. So I thought that was quite interesting. And I'd mentioned earlier as well that Barry had a scrap with Florence Nightingale in the Crimea. As I mentioned, he was sort of known for being kind of like hot-headed and quite a temper on him. And Florence Nightingale actually wrote about Barry. I should say that Barry was the most hardened creature I have ever met. So she was not a fan. I didn't really know anything about him until I think I'd read an article a few weeks ago. And I had mentioned before, he's considered an important figure, not just for the trans community, because he sort of encompasses loads of different communities, just by virtue of the fact that it's hard to sort of put him into a certain box. There's been a lot of people who have identified with Barry, a lot of communities that have, you know, I had mentioned before. There was some debate on his, when Dr. McKinnon had been sort of accosted about the medical certificate that he issued for him, one of the things that he had said in his response was that basically he thought that Barry might have been both. So I thought that Barry was a hermaphrodite. So there's no evidence to suggest that at all. And the woman who laid out the body said was pretty categorical in saying that the body had female genitalia, but she also blackmailed people for money. So it's all kind of, there's not really a sort of reliable source apart from Barry himself, who is obviously not able to tell anyone that. But yeah, he was a very important figure regardless in the medical field, and I think he's quite fascinating because loads of communities identify with him. Feminists, it can be viewed as through a feminist lens, it can be viewed through a trans lens, it could be viewed intersex lens, medical lens, like there's just so many sort of areas and communities that can identify with him. So I thought it was really, really interesting as a sort of early example of someone that didn't conform to gender norms, what we say. And that's me.
Wow.
Surely you wouldn't like go AWOL from your military post and travel all the way back to England for someone that was, you know, that you didn't like.
Yeah.
In my heart, I hope that they were, you know, madly in love, but obviously they couldn't be together.
Yeah.
I think just the fact that he never, if he, like you said, it's the fact that he literally went absent from leave, which was like a punishable offence back then. It was quite serious, like you would get into deep shit for that. But like the fact that he'd done that just to go back and treat him says to me that there was definitely a strong sort of love there. And then also the fact as well that if Somerset had been charged with homosexuality, now back then this was before Becky, you'd said that homosexuality stopped being a capital offence in 1861.
Yeah.
This is pre that. This is in like 1820s, late 1820s, early 1830s. So do you know what I mean? Like, if Lord Charles, if like Somerset and Barry, if they'd been accused of homosexuality and were being investigated for it, that was a capital offence. You would think that the first thing he would say if he knew that Barry was biological female and didn't care about him would be, "Oh well, examine him. Like, I'm no, you can't accuse me of homosexuality if he's biologically a female." But he never done that. Which suggests to me that, I mean, they were obviously later acquitted, but they didn't know at the time that they would be acquitted. So that suggests to me that, I think he did know, but he just, you know, he loved them, so he never said anything. But that's just my own personal opinion. I like to believe in love.
It's quite a sweet, it is actually, it's very sweet, yeah. I've got to admit. Kelly, like, that was really interesting. I mean, the part about the cesarean, I mean... Cesareans have been done for centuries, you know, and for that one to be the first one recorded where both the mother mm-hmm. and the child lived, I thought that was really interesting. Forgive my ignorance, okay, what is intersex? Please, somebody explain.
I can give me 2 seconds to get up the correct terminology, because I googled earlier to make sure I was getting the right stuff.
Thank you.
Okay, so intersex is an individual whose sexual anatomy or chromosomes do not fit with the traditional markers of female and male.
Thank you. There you go. Okay. Explains it, yeah.
I just saw, so I think I'd mentioned earlier about Dr. McKinnon's statement where he basically had, where a lot of people who think that Barry was, might have been intersex comes from him saying this. But I've just pulled a quote up from Dr. Barry's letter, and actually, considering it was written in 1865, I'll just like read a little bit out because I think it's quite interesting. So he basically said, "I informed her," so this is I'm talking about, he's essentially he's saying to the sort of, and other sort of medical people who have sort of accosted him for the fact that he's issued this death certificate, he's essentially explaining what he had said to the woman who had blackmailed him, basically, if that makes sense. So he'd said, "I informed her that all of Dr. Barry's relatives were dead, and that it was no secret of mine, and that my own impression was that Dr. Barry was a hermaphrodite. But whether Dr. Barry was a male, female, or hermaphrodite, I do not know, nor had I any purpose in making the discovery, as I could positively swear to the identity of the body as being that of a person who I had been acquainted with as an inspector general of hospitals for a long number of years."
Mm.
So he pretty much said, like, it's none of your business.
Good.
So.
Good. Yeah, keep your fucking mouth shut.
Mm.
Yeah, good. I like that. Nice. He stood up for his pal, like, you know what I mean? That's loyalty. It's good. It's good. No, Kelly, that genuinely, that was really interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kelly. And yeah, I will go on to the last one we'll talk about, which is bisexual history. So, Cam, question for you. I know, but it's okay for you to say no on this one, I promise.
Okay, thank you.
Have you ever heard of the Kinsey scale?
The Kinsey scale?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Okay, so I only found out about this today, so okay. I'm really excited by this, right? Okay. So, the Kinsey scale was first discussed in The Sexual Behaviour of the Human Male, which was published by Alfred Kinsey in 1948. On a very basic level, it is a grading scale for sexuality. It goes from 0 to 6. 0 is extremely heterosexual, 6 is exclusively homosexual, and in between is varying bisexual levels. There is also, however, I will say, there was a 7th category which wasn't given a number, and it describes what we these days would probably describe more as asexuality.
Okay.
So, the scale was created to demonstrate the idea that sexuality does not fit into 2 strict categories, and instead that sexuality is fluid, and it came from discussions with over 8,000 people. So it had a reasonable sample base. The scale has had a huge impact, and it was widely advertised. The scale was widely advertised and had a huge impact on society's modern conceptions of sexuality post World War II, when we were all a bit excitable anyway. You know, let's face it. Baby boomers.
Baby boomers. Yep.
So So although the scale has its flaws and it has been further defined in this modern era, it's still credited as one of the first attempts to acknowledge the fluidity of human behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's a random scale fact for you.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. But now onto the favourite bet, which is the buy of the day. And I'm going to talk a wee bit about the incredible Josephine Baker. And I'm very excited for this. So, Josephine Baker, born the 3rd of June 1906. At the age of 15, she moved to New York and took up a job as a chorus girl. Baker herself noted that she didn't get her first break until she moved to Paris, however, in the 1920s, when she became an instant success for her erotic dancing. By 1926, she was the star of the, I'm sorry, listeners, I'm going to get this wrong, of the Foyles Berger?
I believe it's Foyles Berger.
A fancy club in Paris.
Nice.
Performing her Danse Sauvage while wearing a costume consisting of a skirt made of a string of artificial bananas. Just a skirt made of a string of artificial bananas.
Nice.
Literally just her, her bananas, and nothing else. The show was incredibly popular and, whilst sexy, had a more serious undertone. Baker, who was African-American, her arrival in Paris coincided with a rise in interest in Europe of black culture, which included a widely accepted belief of the inherent primitiveness of black people. By swinging her hips on that stage in the banana skirt, she seduced many men in the audience, and no doubt a fair few women as well, manipulating and subverting the expectations of those who would call her primitive. And contemporary critic Pierre de Renier described the dance like this. She is in constant motion, her body writhing like a snake, or more precisely, like a dipping saxophone. Music seems to pour from her body. She grimaces, crosses her eyes, wiggles disjointedly, does a split, and finally crawls off the stage, stiff-legged, her rump higher than her head, like a young giraffe. I mean, I've got to be honest with you, I'm a bit weirded out.
Yeah, a little bit.
A bit weird, isn't it?
A little bit weird. Mm.
It wasn't long before Baker was the most successful American entertainer in the whole of France. Mm. Ernest Hemingway called her the most sensational woman anyone ever saw, and the author spent hours talking with her in Paris bars. Mm. As well as that, Picasso drew paintings depicting her alluring beauty. And this is where it gets a little bit troublesome. Women took to trying to darken their own skin in imitation of her, and her slicked back hairstyle was the Rachel of the day.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. As well as her own incredible talents, Baker had a menagerie to help her on stage, all of whom were apparently blinged up with diamonds in various ways. She had a cheetah named Jaquita, who used to jump off stage and attack the orchestra. She had a chimpanzee named Ethel, a horse called Tomato, and a pig called Albert.
Mm-hmm. I like the monkey Ethel. That's just like classic.
That's what I think of when I think of chimpanzees. They should be called Ethel.
All right, Ethel.
I feel like she'd be like your eccentric aunt. Your sort of weird auntie who's like a really good like laugh, but as you're just like, what?
Definitely. So, in December 1934, she took the lead in a six-month run of the opera La Créole at the Théâtre Marigny on the Champs-Élysées of Paris. The training required improved her vocal prowess, and I love this. In the words of Dame Shirley Bassey,
The Dame,
who has cited Baker as her primary influence, she went from a petit danse sauvage, or danseuse sauvage, with a decent voice, to La Grande Diva Magnifique. I swear in all my life I have never seen, and probably never shall see again, such a spectacular singer and performer. And this, coming from The Dame, I think gives some spectacular impression of Josephine Baker.
There you go.
Amazing. So Baker returned to Paris in 1937 and became a French citizen. And if anyone listening isn't already convinced at how amazing Miss Baker was, I think what I'm going to be saying next is going to change your mind. So In September 1939, as we all know, France declared war on Germany in response to the invasion in Poland. And Baker was recruited by French military intelligence.
Yes.
Baker used her celebrity status to rub shoulders with high-ranking individuals from the Axis powers and carried information to be transmitted to the Allied powers about troop numbers, airfields, strategies, anything she could. And she would write this information down either in invisible ink on her sheet music or written in her pants.
Oh,
literally
wow.
Written wow. In her pants.
Nice.
And she argued, who would strip search Josephine Baker? And I just love that. I think it's so cocky. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's good.
She hid Jewish refugees in her home, which was a chateau, by the way. And she supplied them visas where she could to get them out of France. Whilst on the tour of the French colonies in North Africa, later on during the war, she had a miscarriage, which unfortunately caused an infection so severe it required a full hysterectomy.
Oh.
But after minimal recovery time, she began touring to entertain the French, British and American soldiers. This woman is insane.
She's a boss.
She's an absolute baller. Quite understandably, after the war, she received the Croix de Guerre, the Rosette de la Résistance, and she was made a Chevalier of the Légion d'Honneur by General Charles de Gaulle.
Fucking damn right.
Damn right.
Damn right.
So in 1951, Baker was invited back to the United States for a nightclub engagement in Miami. After winning a public battle over desegregating the club's audience, Baker followed up with a sold-out national tour. During a visit to the Stork Club in Manhattan, she was refused service and made charges of racism against the club. After this, she was accused of communist sympathies, and the ensuing publicity resulted in the termination of Baker's work visa. Because if you remember, she was a French citizen at this point.
Right.
This forced her to cancel all of her engagements and return to France, and it was almost a decade before US officials allowed her back into the country.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. But they did, and in 1963, she spoke at the March on Washington at the side of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
Woo-hoo!
Baker was the only official female speaker at the march, and Rosa Parks and Daisy Bates were among those she acknowledged, and both gave brief unofficial speeches. But not everyone involved actually wanted her at the march, because some thought that her time overseas had made her more of a woman of France than America, and they were worried that she was disconnected from the civil rights issues going on in America. But Josephine, Queen Josephine, as she shall henceforth be known, made a very powerful speech, and one of the things that she very notably said was this: I have walked into the palaces of kings and queens and into the houses of presidents and much more, but I could not walk into a hotel in America and get a cup of coffee, and that made me mad. And when I get mad, you know that I open my big mouth, and then look out, because when Josephine opens her mouth, they hear it all over the world.
Yes, yeah.
Absolute fucking baller. She's amazing. But I just kind of want to stop there and move on to the reason that we are here today, and that is to talk about her not just being an incredible woman professionally and personally, but also to talk a wee bit about her being a bisexual icon. So it was her son, Jean-Claude, that he wrote a biography of her and talked a lot about her life and her being bisexual. She was married four times: to Willie Wells when she was 13, to William Baker when she was 15, and to Jean Leon and Joe Bullion when she was of a more legal age.
I just love Kelly's faces. Kelly and I both kind of like, doesn't even make any better.
I know it doesn't.
Fuck that.
So she was like twice divorced when she was like 16.
Yeah.
Fuck, all right then, man.
Yeah, but she, as well as being married full time, she also had numerous relationships with women. So she is known to have had relationships with Clara Smith, who was a successful blues singer who recorded over 100 songs and worked with Louis Armstrong, Ada Bricktop Smith, who was an incredibly influential club owner, French novelist Colette, a performer who near enough caused a riot by kissing her female lover on stage at the Moulin Rouge.
Oh, wow.
Apparently the police were called.
At the Moulin Rouge?
Yeah, I know, right?
What the fuck do you expect, boy? Come on.
I know, right? And also Bessie Buchanan, the first African-American woman to have a seat in the New York legislature. I can't speak today. Now, there is also rumours that she had a bit of a a tryst with Frida Kahlo.
Oh.
But, although there is photographic evidence that they met, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that they did the horizontal dance with no pants.
Ah.
But in my mind, they would have been an amazing couple.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's not certain whether Baker was out during her own lifetime. Although the artistic circles that she moved in Paris would have allowed her to be more fluid, the reactions of the wider world could have damaged her career. There's no way really of knowing whether or not she was out when she was doing her thing. Mm-hmm. But I think we can all agree that she is an absolute boss.
Yes.
And an icon. And if they don't do a movie about her, then they really need to.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, yeah, that's me.
Becky, again, thank you very much. Interesting to know about the aspects, the part of life in the Second World War. Absolute fucking hero. Compared to, I would just like to mention Coco Chanel, you Nazi bitch.
And Hugo Boss too.
Yes, and Hugo Boss,
Hugo Boss.
Hugo Boss designed the SS uniforms.
I know that, but Coco was fine.
No,
she was Nazi.
I wear Mademoiselle. Oh no.
Oh dear.
I've recently switched to Jupe, so it's fine. I'm not giving them any more money.
Well, I think we can maybe do the old Second World War later on, but like certainly very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, babe.
Yeah, it was really good. Thank you much.
Are you ready for the quiz?
No, but let's do it. Let's go.
Okay.
Okay, so, here we go.
So this is directed just at Cam.
Oh fuck.
Question number one. How many years do we believe Turing's work shortened the Second World War by?
Two.
2 years and 14 million lives. Who was the original Dr. James Barry?
Can I say her name?
Yes. Where would Josephine Baker hide the information she was smuggling to the Allies?
Oh, yes. I know. In her knickers.
Or in her musical sheets of paper, her notes.
Yes.
Or her musical sheets. So, what does the Greek word for lesbians mean?
Is it Lesbos Island?
I was thinking more of the fellatio, but yeah, cool.
Okay, fellatio too. Fellatio and Lesbos.
What is the reversed form of the Turing test that we still use on a regular basis?
Capture, motherfucker!
Yeah. What is Dr. Barry known for, professionally speaking?
Being a surgeon.
Cesarean to have a...
It's not your quiz. You're not supposed to be answering. Sorry.
The next time I'm ever having an interview or a pub quiz, I'm going to have you right behind me, like genuinely. Cameron, can you tell us about a time? Cameron, see these! Don't fucking say that! Yeah! Wait, you're not Russian, are you? Sorry. Agreed. Oh, she! Is that right? No. It's not.
No, you sound Jamaican in both
cases. Jamaican Greek, I'll take that. Thank you.
What is Dr. Barry known for, professionally speaking?
Okay. Performing the first cesarean. Yes, Maria, I see you. Performing the first cesarean where both successfully the child and the mother survived. And being a surgeon.
Yes. He performed the first recorded C-section by a European in Africa, in which both the mother and the child. And he also improved medical conditions in the British West Indies. Breast West Indies? What am I talking about? The British West Indies.
Thank you.
What did Josephine Baker wear during her Danse Sauvage?
She would wear a string with bananas on it, like a banana string skirt. Thank you, Maria. I see the banana.
How fucking AIDS, the first time I actually can answer a quiz. And I'm not allowed to partake in it. Fine. Carry on.
I'm just sitting like, mustn't say anything.
Who did Dr. Barry leave Mauritius to care for?
Lord Somerset.
Yes. Which long overdue law pardoned men in England and Wales who had been cautioned or convicted under the historical legislation that outlawed homosexual acts? You can either give me the actual name or the kind of nickname.
The abbreviation. Was it the Turing Law 2017?
Yeah, pretty much. So the Alan Turing Act.
Alan Turing Act.
The actual name of which was the Policing and Crime Act 2017.
Okay, thank you.
And finally, name any and all of the animals in Josephine Baker's menagerie that we learnt today.
Ethel monkey.
Tomato.
Yep.
It would appear, listeners, that we actually have two cameras on the podcast.
Can I say please? Please.
No, you fucking can't. My quiz, I don't fucking win them, okay? It's the first time in two fucking seasons. It's mine, right, okay? I win, not you.
Oh, that's
horrible. Can't even fucking speak. Are you going to fucking interrupt me as well? All right.
So it was a cheetah named
Chupandita.
Just don't fucking stop, do you?
It was a cheetah named.
Fucking speak now!
Chikamon!
Was it Chiquita?
Chiquita! Chiquita!
And what did Chiquita used to do?
Attack the opera.
A chimpanzee called.
Ethel. Tomato. Tomato.
And a pig called.
Pierre?
Albert.
Albert. Ah, oh, fuck.
You've got 10.
Brilliant.
You've got 10 out of 10.
Fantastic. Maria, how many did you get?
I wasn't playing.
So, I think on that note, thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Just a reminder, we have a Twitter account, which is at HIAH Podcast.
Beautiful.
So feel free to give us a like and, listen to the shit that we put on there. If anyone has any thoughts about what they want us to talk about as well, they are more than welcome to send us some an email. It is historicalinaccuraciespodcast@outlook.com. Thank you very much, guys. It's been brilliant. So it's a thank you from Kelly.
Thank you. Goodbye.
It's a thank you from Maria. It's a thank you from Cam.
Thank you.
And it's a thank you from me. Bye.